This is East End Inc. Today we present portions of a community reading of the work of Native American writers recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in November 2018. The program started with commentary from Richard Lawless.
Last Wednesday, this past Wednesday, I was privileged to stand with about 250 people on the West Mall of the U.S. Capitol. And among those 250 people were tribal leaders from all over the continent, from Alaska and California. And they were there in support of the Mashpee Wampanoags, the people who welcomed the pilgrims, who are under attack from the Department of the Interior, stand once again, at risk of losing land that has been theirs for centuries. And that, you know, that's what was amazing was the strength and the power of these people, and on an even deeper level, their connection to land. That land is something more than a possession or something that you could get a deed for. And that's where I want to start with a poem by a Kiowa man, N. Scott Momade. Some of you know him. Kiowa is the nation that my friend, the late Bobby Unko, came from. Bobby was a longtime resident of the Shinnecock Reservation and was a great friend and taught me a great deal about the land. This is N. Scott Momade's poem, The Earth. Once in his life, a man ought to concentrate his mind upon the remembered earth. He ought to give himself up to a particular landscape in his experience, to look at it from as many angles as he can, to wonder about it, to dwell upon it. He ought to imagine that he touches it with his hands at every season and listens to the sounds that are made upon it. He ought to imagine the creatures there and all the faintest motions in the wind. He ought to recollect the glare of noon and all the colors of the dawn and dusk. For we are held by more than the force of gravity to the earth. It is the entity from which we are sprung, and that into which we are dissolved in time. The blood of the whole human race is invested in it. We are moored there, rooted there, surely as deeply as are the ancient redwoods and bristlecones. And on that serious note, thought we needed a bit of relief. There's a wonderful man, if you don't know about him, called John Fire Lame Deer. Contemporary, was at a peace demonstration that Martin Luther King had called in New York City in 1967. And he's an old, supposedly illiterate Sioux medicine man. And he meets this Caucasian writer, Richard Erdos. And at dinner, turns to Richard and says, "I like you. I think I'm going to stay with you." Richard and he had several years of collaboration that were wonderful. And this is a book called Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions, wonderful little collection. And the name of this is called Sitting on Top of Teddy Roosevelt's Head. Okay, so imagine Mount Rushmore in the back, all right? Here we are sitting on Teddy Roosevelt's head. Giving him a headache, maybe. If we get tired of the view from here, we could move over and sit for a while on Washington or Lincoln or Jefferson. But Teddy is by far the best. There is moss growing near the back of his skull. Lots of trees, firewood, boulders to lean your back against. A little hollow surrounded by pines, which makes a nice campground. Especially with that cliff rising behind it, on which that big Red Power, Indian Land sign is painted. It looks nice, doesn't it? Actually, we're not sitting exactly on Teddy's head, which is bald and smooth, but in back of it, halfway toward Lincoln. We are really higher than any of these heads. One good thing about being on top of Mount Rushmore, it's the only place around here where you don't have to look at those big faces. These giant tourist curios, ashtrays, paperweights. I know a Santee Indian who some years ago climbed up here one night with a few friends just to pee down the nose of one of those faces. He called it a symbolic gesture. The way he told it to me, it was quite a feat. They had to form a human chain to make it possible for him to do it. Don't get me wrong. We hold no grudge against Lincoln, Jefferson, or Washington. They signed a few good treaties with us, and it wasn't their fault that they weren't kept. What we object to is the white man's arrogance and self-love. His disregard for nature, which makes him desecrate one of our holy mountains with these oversized pale faces. It's symbolic, too, that this shrine of democracy, these four faces, are up to their chins in one tremendous pile of rubble, a million tons of jagged, blasted, dynamited stone reaching all the way down to the visitor center. If you look up the mountain the way most tourists do, you see these four heads rising out of something like a giant abandoned mine dump. But nobody seems to notice that. That really got me thinking. What does this Mount Rushmore mean to us Indians? It means these big white faces are telling us, first we gave you Indians a treaty that you could keep these Black Hills forever, as long as the sun would shine, in exchange for all the Dakotas, Wyoming, and Montana. Then we found the gold and took this last piece of land because we were stronger. And there was more of us than there were of you, and because we had cannons and Gatling guns, while you hadn't even progressed far enough to make a steel knife. And when you didn't want to leave, we wiped you out. And those of you who survived, we put on reservations. And then we took the gold out, $1 billion. And we aren't through yet. And because we like the tourist dollars too, we've made your sacred Black Hills into one vast Disneyland. And after we did all this, we carved up this mountain, the dwelling place of your spirits, and put our four gleaming white faces here. We are the conquerors.
Hi, my name is Kelly Dennis, and my Algonquin name is Takine Hadonamo Jinamonsenyang Tenupsog. I am a member of the Shinnecock Indian Nation and also of the Hassanamisco Nipmuc Nation. And I am reading pieces from the book Lifting Hearts Off the Ground by Lila June Johnston. She is Navajo, Diné, and Cheyenne. And she co-authored this with Joy DeVito as a poetic rendition of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She's really fun to be around. I had the privilege of working with her a few years back on an event for Native American Heritage Month. And she's also a great guitarist and musician in addition to a writer. And many of our tribe members have also been able to spend time with her and others on the Standing Rock efforts. So. Here's the first one. There are laws, and then there are laws. Some of us have forgotten that ink on paper can be burned, torn, obeyed, and disobeyed. Other laws, written into bone and sand, are more lovable and lasting. Love says she is the judge of judges. Without her, we will perish. Not as punishment, but as natural fact. This was from the I call it the UNDRIP, Article 27, which states that states shall establish and implement in conjunction with Indigenous peoples concerned a fair, independent, impartial, open, and transparent process, giving due recognition to Indigenous peoples' laws, traditions, customs, and land tenure systems to recognize and adjudicate the rights of Indigenous peoples pertaining to their lands, territories, and resources, including those which were traditionally owned and otherwise occupied or used. Indigenous peoples have the right to participate in this process. When the city leaves you purposeless, and you find yourself at the bottom of a bottle, and the spirit reminds you of your ability and purpose, responsibility. To a people, to the waiting earth, becomes your savior. Go out and fight, warrior. We will always be at your side, even in the middle of the battlefield. And this poem is in regards to Article 35 of the UNDRIPT, which states Indigenous peoples have the right to determine the responsibilities of individuals to their communities. Another one. When we love in the face of hatred, we can loosen the screws of the machine of oppression, for who stands unfazed in the face of grace? Only the expertly numb. The rest of the world, the majority, trembles in the best ways. They are shaken, they are inspired, they are transformed, they are forgiven. This is the truest, most lasting justice. This is from Article 40 of the UNDRIP. Indigenous peoples have the right to have access to and prompt decision through just and fair procedures for the resolution of conflicts and disputes with states and other parties. Please do not call this land America. If you listen, you will hear her true name as the nighthawks dive at twilight, as the wolves howl at moonlight, as the waterfalls rage cascading, as the avalanches fracture, breaking. She will tell you her true name, with earthquakes that split states and break fences to remind you she does not belong to you. We cannot write your rights on a paper, and you cannot write ours either. They are written into the bark of trees. They are written in the silence between you and me. Still, we try like fumbling humans, and no matter its shortcomings, there is the honor we seek, the honor we need to breathe. This was from Article 43 of the UNDRIP. The rights recognized herein constitute the minimum standards for the survival, dignity, and well-being of the Indigenous peoples of the world. Time will tell the course of our collective. We are one in the end. Some are parrots, some are falcons, some are cranes, and some are pigeons. But at sunset, we are all birds, needing a place to roost, a nest, to shield us from the winter wind. See me in you, see you in me. We will learn this lesson hard together. Some will starve, some will overeat, some will freeze, some will overheat. Recycled souls evaporate, then drop against the parched canvas of the earth, smelling like the sweet aspiration of a trillion lives lived. Love sustains us, love recreates us, love remains after all the blood and all the pain. Love remains, love remains. And that was Article 46 of the UNDRIP. And it's a kind of a lengthy one with three separate articles, but in the end, it's that the UNDRIP will be upheld and will be interpreted in accordance of Indigenous peoples and their principles of justice and democracy. So Lila June Johnston's book is available online at www.commonworld.ca.gov/1516, and all profits benefit Indigenous community projects. Thank you.
Kathleen Goldhirsch. Tiger Butter by Diane Glancy. And she teaches at McAllister College. She's won a Pushcart Award and many other awards for her poetry and prose. Is it only when you're little you know tigers live in your closet? One with your shoes on his two ears, another with your umbrella tied to his tail, the rest wearing your red coat and blue trousers with the red buttons. Is it only when you're little, the dust balls have mountainous shadows in the crack of light under the door? Or is it also now you fear that tigers will eat you when you wake in the middle of the night and don't know where you are, nor remember how far you've come? Your nose hurts like a plowed field, your fingers stiff. Then somehow you remember what you've accomplished, The sewing is finished, the red buttons threaded to the blue pants, and the little coat with its sleeves. And you know you have given them to the tigers so they won't eat you. But they chased themselves around a tree and melted into butter. Now you can pick up your coat and trousers, your shoes and umbrella. Soon, even, you can start your car and go. The promise of dawn already on the face of the clock radio.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to a community reading of the work of Native American writers recorded at Canyon's Books in Sag Harbor in November 2018.
I'm Penny Kerr, and I would like to read a short writing by Ohayesa, who was a Sioux Indian who was born in Minnesota in 1858. And he actually saw the largest mass execution in 1862, where they actually hung, I think, 38 Native people. Sioux were hung for an uprising because they weren't getting treated the way they wanted to by the United States government, and they were eventually pushed, the Sioux were pushed out to the Dakotas. The reality of psychic powers. It is well accepted that the Indian had well-developed psychic powers. A Sioux prophet predicted the coming of the white man fully 50 years before the event, and even described accurately his garments and weapons. Before the steamboat was invented, another prophet of our race described the fireboat that would swim upon the mighty river, the Mississippi. Some of us also seem to have a peculiar intuition for the locality of a grave. Those who possess this sensitivity often explain it by saying that they have received a communication from the spirit of the departed. My own grandmother was one of these. As far as back as I can remember, when camping in a strange country, my brother and I would search for and find human bones at the spot she had indicated to us as an ancient burial place, or the spot where a lone warrior had fallen. Of course, the outward signs of burial had long since been obliterated. She had other remarkable premonitions or intuitions that I recall. I heard her speak of a peculiar sense in the breast, by which, as she said, she was advised of anything of importance concerning her absent children. Other Native women have claimed a similar moniteur, but I never heard of one who could interpret it with such accuracy. We were once camping on Lake Manitoba when we received news that my uncle and his family had been murdered several weeks before at a fort some 200 miles distance. While all our clan were wailing and mourning, my grandmother calmly bade them cease, saying that her son was approaching and that they would see him shortly. Although we had no other reason to doubt it, the ill tiding, it was a fact that my uncle came into camp 2 days after his reported death. At another time, when I was 14 years old, we had just left Fort Ellis on the Assiniboine River, and my youngest uncle had selected a fine spot for our night camp. It was already after sundown, but my grandmother became unaccountably nervous and positively refused to pitch her tent. So we reluctantly went down to the river and camped after dark at a secluded place. The next day, we learned that a family who were following close behind had stopped at the place first selected by my uncle, but were surprised in the night by a roving war party, and all were massacred. This incident made a great impression on our people. Many of us believe that one may be born more than once, and there are some who claim to have full knowledge of a former incarnation. There are also those who believe in a twin spirit born into another tribe or race. There once was a well-known Sioux war prophet who lived in the middle of the last century, so that he is still remembered by the old men of his band. After he had reached middle age, he declared he had a spirit brother among the Ojibwa, the ancestral enemies of the Sioux. He even named the band to which his brother belonged, and said that he also was a war prophet among his people. Upon one of their hunts along the border between the two tribes, the Sioux leader one evening called his warriors together and solemnly declared to them that they were about to meet a like band of Ojibwa hunters led by his spirit twin. Since this was to be their first meeting since they were born as strangers, he earnestly begged the young men to resist the temptation to join battle with their tribal foes. "You will know him at once," the prophet said to them, "for he will not only look like me in face and form, but he will display the same totem and even sing my war songs." They sent out scouts who soon returned with news of the approaching party. Then the leading men started with their peace pipe for the Ojibwe camp, and when they were near at hand, they fired three distinct volleys, a signal for their desire for a peaceful meeting. The response came in a like manner, and they entered the camp with the peace pipe in the hands of the prophet. Lo, the stranger prophet advanced to meet them, and the people were greatly struck with the resemblance between the two men, who met and embraced each other with unusual fervor. It was quickly agreed by both parties that they should camp together for several days, and one evening the Sioux made a warrior's feast, to which they invited many of the Ojibwa. The prophet asked his twin brother to sing one of his sacred songs, and behold, it was the very song that he himself was wont to sing. No doubt, many such stories were altered and shaded after the fact, and unquestionably false prophets and conjurers abounded during the times of tribulation when the white races overtook our people. But I know that our people possessed remarkable powers of concentration and abstraction, and I believe that such nearness to nature, as I have described, keeps the spirit sensitive to impressions not commonly felt and in touch with the...
I'm Maggie Bloomfield. I'm going to read a poem by Sherman Alexie. I think he's fairly well known, poet, author, filmmaker, a member of the Spokane Coeur d'Alene American tribe. This is Grief Calls Us to the Things of This World. It's based on The Morning Air is All Awash with Angels, Richard Wilbur. Love calls us to the things of this world. The eyes open to a blue telephone in the bathroom of this 5-star hotel. I wonder whom should I call? A plumber, proctologist, urologist, or priest? Who is blessed among us and most deserves the first call? I choose my father, because he's astounded by bathroom telephones. I dial home. My mother answers. "Hey, Ma," I say, "can I talk to Papa?" She gasps. And then I remember that my father has been dead for nearly a year. "Mom," I say, "I forgot he's dead. I'm sorry. How did I forget?" "It's okay," she says. "I made him a cup of instant coffee this morning and left it on the table, like I have for, 27 years. And I didn't realize my mistake until this afternoon." My mother laughs at the angels who wait for us to pause during the most ordinary of days and sing our praise to forgetful falling. Snare us and haul us, pray and praying into dust.
I am Lisa Votino Tarrant. For those that don't know me, I live on Shinnecock, but I be a white girl. I'm also reading Sherman Alexie. This is called How to Write the Great American Indian Novel. All of the Indians must have tragic features, tragic nose, eyes, and arms. Their hands and fingers must be tragic when they reach for tragic food. The hero must be a half-breed, half white and half Indian, preferably from a horse culture. He should often weep alone. That is mandatory. If the hero is an Indian woman, she is beautiful. She must be slender and in love with a white man. But if she loves an Indian man, then he must be a half-breed, preferably from a horse culture. If the Indian woman loves a white man, then he has to be so white that we can see the blue veins running through his skin like rivers. When the Indian woman steps out of her dress, the white man gasps at the endless beauty of her brown skin. She should be compared to nature. Brown hills, mountains, fertile valleys, dewy grass, wind, and clear water. If she is compared to murky water, however, then she must have a secret. Indians always have secrets, which are carefully and slowly revealed. Yet Indian secrets can be disclosed suddenly like a storm. Indian men, of course, are storms. They should destroy the lives of any white women who choose to love them. All white women love Indian men. That is always the case. White women feign disgust at the savage in blue jeans and t-shirt, but secretly lust after him. White women dream about half-breed Indian men from horse cultures. Indian men are horses, smelling wild and gamey. When the Indian man unbuttons his pants, the white woman should think of topsoil. There must be one murder, one suicide, one attempted rape. Alcohol should be consumed. Cars must be driving at high speeds. Indians must see visions. White people can have the same vision if they are in love with Indians. If a white person loves an Indian, then the white person is Indian by proximity. White people must carry an Indian deep inside themselves. Those interior Indians are half-breed and obviously from horse cultures. If the interior Indian is male, then he must be a warrior, especially if he is inside a white man. If the interior Indian is female, then she must be a healer, especially if she is inside a white woman. Sometimes there are complications. An Indian man can be hidden inside a white woman, and an Indian woman can be hidden inside a white man. In these rare instances, everybody is a half-breed struggling to learn more about his or her horse culture. There must be redemption, of course, and sins must be forgiven. For this, we need children. A white child and an Indian child. Gender not important, should express deep affection in a childlike way. In the great American Indian novel, when it is finally written, all of the white people will be Indians, and all of the Indians will be ghosts.
We heard portions of a community reading from the work of Native American writers recorded at Canio's Books Sag Harbor in November 2018. The readers were Maggie Bloomfield, Kelly Dennis, Kathleen Goldhirsch, Penny Kerr, Richard Lawless, and Lisa Rotino Tarrant. Some free literary events sponsored by Canio's Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor, include on Sunday, February the 10th at 3 p.m. at the Unitarian Meeting House on Sag Harbor Bridgehampton Turnpike, a book discussion of the Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, sponsored by Racial Justice East End. On Sunday, February 24th at the John Germain Library Main Street in Sag Harbor, the annual African American Literature Read-In. Contact Canio's at 631-725-4926 to sign up to read. More events are listed at canios.wordpress.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Zoker and Marianne Callendrill. This is Hazel Kahn.